This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Making plans with asthma can be awful. It always goes from, that sounds fun, to, in this weather, what if my asthma acts up? I got tired of saying no. So my doctor suggested Dupixent. I'm Rachel, and I'm sponsored by Regeneron and Sanofi to share my story with real patients like me.
Dupixent, dupilumab, is an add-on prescription maintenance treatment for adults and children 6 years and up with moderate to severe eosinophilic or oral steroid-dependent asthma that's not controlled with current asthma medicines. Dupixent is not for sudden breathing problems.
Dupixent helps people breathe better in as little as 2 weeks. And now I don't even think twice about saying yes to plans more, rain or shine.
Severe allergic reactions, including skin reactions, can occur. Get help right away for face, mouth, tongue, or throat swelling, wheezing, or trouble breathing. Tell your doctor right away of signs of inflamed blood vessels like rash, chest pain, worsening shortness of breath, brown or dark-colored urine, tingling or numbness in limbs. Tell your doctor of new or worsening skin symptoms, joint aches and pain, or a parasitic infection. Don't change or stop other treatments without talking to your doctor.
Do more with less asthma. Ask your asthma specialist about Dupixent by name. Visit Dupixent.com or call 1-844-DUPIXENT.
The Pelicans, some of the more interesting ones were broke up with a loser boyfriend. Somebody said, my favorite part is now it's finally over. Somebody else said, my months-old first grandson opening his presents. It was awesome. I don't know how a month-old can open presents, but I guess they did. I guess it depends on how many months. I don't remember with kids. Somebody else said they went to the World War II Museum for the first time. And they loved it so much they went back a second and third time. So good for them. So text in your favorite holiday memory to 504-260-1870. I can guarantee you Nicolas Maduro's favorite holiday memory was not what happened to him over the weekend. Greg Upton joins us now, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies, to talk about the oil aspects of this. Good morning, Greg. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Tommy. Good morning.
Let's talk about the history of oil production in Venezuela, because I think we need to know how it developed before we can get to where we are now.
Yeah, sure. So when you go back to the 80s and 90s, oil production in Venezuela was growing pretty rapidly. And if you look right before Chavez took control in 1999, the year before that, Venezuela was producing more than 3 million barrels a day, which at the time was almost 5% of global oil production. And
wait,
so it was
powerhouse. Go back, say that again.
So before Hugo Chavez took power in 1999, the year before that, Venezuela was producing around 3 million barrels a day of oil, and that accounted for
Are you saying million or billion?
Million. Barrels a day, yeah. And that accounted at the time for almost 5% of global oil production.
All right.
And so Venezuela was really a powerhouse, very, very important oil producer kind of on that global scene.
Now, let me jump in. When you say Venezuela, was it nationalized or was it companies like Chevron or whomever, I don't know, pick an oil company that was in there drilling for oil and giving the country a percentage of it?
This was pre the nationalization. So companies like Chevron were there and they were producing oil, of course, offshore, similar to what we have here in the United States, where it's not the government that's producing it. It's the private companies that are actually doing the extraction.
And was the government, were the people of Venezuela making out on that deal? Was that a good deal for them?
You know, I probably can't opine on whether they would think it was a good deal or not, but certainly economically, Venezuela was doing pretty well around that time period.
Okay, so let's talk about the business model as it relates to the United States, because the United States doesn't drill for oil. Companies drill for oil, and the United States makes money, each state makes money through royalties. Is that how it works? So the federal government gets royalties?
Well, it's going to depend if it's on state lands, if it's on federal lands and water bottoms, or if it's on a private, private individual's
land. Is there a nation akin to Venezuela pre-Chavez to which you can make a comparison to help us understand this?
Oh, my gosh. Pre-Chavez, I mean, So the United States is actually very unique in that landowners own the oil under their land.
Okay.
And so that's very unique. And so most parts of the world, you as the landowner don't have access to actual ownership of the minerals thousands of feet below your land. And so the U.S., in fact, one of the reasons the U.S. has been so successful in oil and gas production and why we're a global leader is because we have that unique regulatory regime. Of course, there's also the geology and the access to the resources. And so within Venezuela, I doubt that that was the case even before Chavez took over.
Okay. So Chavez takes over in 99, and what happens then to the oil industry in Venezuela?
So within about 5 years, it crashes pretty significantly. They lose about a third of their production, and then it's able to bounce back a little bit, and it kind of stabilizes there. And, of course, that was a time of relatively high prices, and so we kind of saw kind of stable production in Venezuela until, of course, Maduro takes over in 2013 upon Chavez's death.
Why did it crash when Chavez took over?
So I think it's reasonable to believe that the moving to the national oil companies and the kind of nationalization of that and a lot of the global companies left at that time. And so that would have been an adjustment to their, you know, to their oil industry. And so they saw that reduction, and then they were kind of able to figure it out over time, and then that's whenever they saw production stabilize.
Aha. And of course, so you said figure it out over time, so I was thinking, as you said that, it would be akin to the government taking something over, but they didn't quite know what they were doing because the private companies were on it, and the private companies were saying, well, if you're going to take it over, fine. I guess they seized whatever production capabilities the private companies had. Is that what happened?
That's correct. And they did have partnerships with private companies. For instance, Chevron is the big example that's been in Venezuela for a long time. But certainly there was the nationalization through PDVSA, which is the national oil company that owns all of the production in Venezuela.
Gotcha. So Maduro takes over upon Chavez's death in 2013. What happens then?
And then, of course, we have the 2014 price crash that occurs right after that. And that's when Venezuela, both economically and in terms of oil production, just declined significantly over that few-year period. In fact, GDP per capita within Venezuela dropped by over 70%, which is almost unheard of to think about that. And so today, oil production in Venezuela is less than 1 million barrels per day. It's less than 1% of global production. And economically, Venezuela has been in a really, really difficult situation these last few years. So definitely not the peak times that we saw before Chavez took power.
So why did that happen? Why did they go from 3 million to 1 million a day and less than 1% or whatever the percentage was globally?
So there's a few things. The first is, of course, the market forces, where we had, with the 2014 price crash, you had oil go from over $100 a barrel to drop to about $30 a barrel in just about a six-month time period. You might recall, even here in Louisiana, we went through a little recession while the U.S. was in expansion mode. And so Venezuela is significantly more exposed to that oil and gas industry than we are here in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And so that really negatively impacted it. Of course, the other reason is sanctions. And so there's a long, you know, kind of history of the U.S. sanctions on Venezuela and the impact of those, and then the private companies being in Venezuela as part of the, you know, partnering with the national oil companies and then not being able to. And so it's the complexity of kind of these geopolitical events, alongside, of course, the market fundamentals of that price being relatively low. And those two things together led to a really big reduction in production.
So when it comes to producing oil or gas in Venezuela today, who is in control of that, the government?
That's right. So it's PDVSA is their national oil company, and they own all of the production, and they also own, I believe it's 5 refineries in Venezuela. And so it's the national oil company, that's essentially the government that's in control of the of assets there.
Would you say that the government mismanaged that? Because you talk about market forces. I know they are a member of OPEC. What part does that play in all of this?
So that's going to play a part of it in terms of, you know, their production. And, of course, they're going to respond to when OPEC tries to increase production or hold back those increases in production. So Venezuela is going to respond to that as a member of OPEC. So that certainly has a, you know, has an impact. And then in terms of course, the national oil company itself, those are, you know, really a different dynamic than we have here in the U.S. Of course, you look at, you know, like Saudi Aramco is another example of Saudi Arabia. They have a national oil company and they've been very successful. And so I don't want to downplay that necessarily all national oil companies, you know, are unsuccessful in the long run. But certainly Venezuela has had, you know, all these geopolitical challenges, that have really negatively impacted its industry.
So you're saying per capita GDP dropped 70%. Is it to the average Venezuelan's benefit or to the industries in Venezuela's benefit to be a member of OPEC or not? Is that a net plus or minus?
Ooh, that's a hard question. You know, there's trade-offs there. I mean, the whole benefit of being part of OPEC is that, you know, OPEC's goal is really to have price stability over time, mm-hmm. for the global oil price, and also have a little bit higher price over time. Because, of course, if you're exporting a commodity, you would like that commodity to sell for a higher price on the market. And you also would like for there to be less volatility in the price of that commodity for two reasons. First of all, you want, of course, the revenue stability for the countries. But also, you don't want demanders of that product to say, look, I'm tired of all these big fluctuations. I'm going to go invest in other sources of energy. And so the benefit to, you know, really the global market is that, again, the little bit higher prices and lower stability or less volatility. But for an individual country, that's going to be nuanced, right? Because when the price is high, you might say, hey, I want to sell more of that product. But OPEC might collectively decide, hey, we're actually going to hold back a little bit. And so, you know, the nuances for every individual member is going to be different. But that's the kind of idea of OPEC. And, of course, if everyone breaks apart, then, you know, then you don't get the benefits of the whole regime. So it's a double-edged sword for all the members, for sure.
How important is oil to the overall economic health of Venezuela? Is that their only thing, or do they produce other things? Tell me about that.
It's very important. I mean, you can look, and I'm looking at, data right now, looking at inflation-adjusted GDP per capita. And before the 2014 price crash, it was somewhere in the ballpark of about $20,000 U.S. And that's in 2015, kind of inflation-adjusted dollars. If you look after the price crash, that dropped to around $5,000.
Wow.
And so, I mean, we just, you know, living in the United States, yeah, we see these business cycle fluctuations, and you'll see, you know, GDP growth go up and down. But, you know, I don't think that anyone here has experienced the level of fluctuation that they've seen there. And so that seems a pretty clear indicator that they're way more exposed to that oil production than even a, you know, historically oil and gas state like Louisiana is, significantly more.
All right, let me take a break. Our eyes will deglaze and we'll pick it up when we come back. And I guess we'll start with economically, what is the situation like for the average Venezuelan, and where does the rehabilitation, if you want to use that word, of the oil industry factor into raising that per capita GDP for the average Venezuelan? Greg Upton is our guest, director of LSU Center for Energy Studies. A lot to unpack here. We're trying to go through it as carefully and as make as much sense as we can. We'll be back in a flash. Tommy Tucker, WWL. All right, 9:28. I think we all know what happened with Maduro over the weekend. And now we're talking about the oil industry in Venezuela and what happens from here with Greg Upton, director of LSU's Center for Energy Studies. So, Greg, when it comes to the per capita GDP of the average Venezuelan citizen, what can be done to rehabilitate the oil industry where, since that is where Venezuela's wealth lies, correct me if I'm saying anything wrong, What can be done to make it profitable for Venezuela again and improve that per capita GDP?
Yeah, so the good news for Venezuela is that the fundamentals are really strong for them. So they have over 300 billion barrels of what's called proved reserves. And so that's oil that they know is in the ground that they can be extracted. That is actually the largest amount of proved reserves of any country in the entire world.
And
so it's really, really underutilized.
Billion with a B?
300 billion, that's
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, first of all, when, in the 90s, whenever the government really took significant autonomy over PDVSA, over the, you know, with the National Oil Company, and they really saw those contractions, and there was a lot of, all those U.S. companies and the global companies had to leave. And so the big key is to bring that investment back, you really need that political stability. And so just like we talk about here in the Gulf of America and the United States, you know, companies are making hundreds of millions of dollars investment, and those investments pay off over, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20-year time horizons. And so if you want companies from all over the world to come in, if you want them to deploy that capital in order to revitalize that industry, it's really that political stability that I think is really the key. And so, of course, right now with everything going on, of course, there's a lot of political instability. There's a lot of uncertainty. And so even if the Venezuelan government were to allow for increased partnerships of these companies to come in, the question to me would be, you know, is a company going to be willing to deploy capital in an environment that there's all that risk in? And so the fundamentals and the oil is there, but you got to get the regulatory structures in place.
And that brings me to the next question about infrastructure and capital investment and how much would be needed. Is the infrastructure there already?
So the infrastructure is aging, and that's a lot of the problem, is that, you know, they haven't really been drilling a lot of new wells. There have been a few rigs over the last year or two that have been out there, but really not a lot of investment going on. And so a lot of it has just been maintaining that historical infrastructure that they have. And you could do that for a little while, and you can keep production stable doing that. But to really have that growth in production, and then therefore the growth in the economic activity and the revenues to the government, you really need to bring in that outside capital. And again, how do you bring in that outside capital? You know, you need to give companies uncertainty. You need to give them more certainty. So, of course, there's going to be uncertainty about prices and kind of the economic outlook. But in terms of the regulatory regime, companies need to know, hey, look, if I go and invest here and I'm going to put my capital there, I'm going to be able to earn a rate of return on that. And that's the big key to driving capital formation.
By comparison, the Biden administration's feeling about oil led to, I guess, disinvestment maybe or lack of investment in the United States because of the instability of the atmosphere, right? So when you're talking about something like Venezuela, that's exponentially more unstable, accurate or not?
Oh, way more unstable. That's correct. I mean, we talk about the political uncertainty in the United States, and I don't mean to, you know, undermine that's an important issue and, of course, impacts real people within the energy sector here. But the level of political instability in a place like Venezuela is almost uncomparable to the kind of political instability and uncertainty we've seen here in the United States around the energy sector.
But so I guess the point I'm trying to make is you would have to take a giant leap toward some type of political basis, some type of political stability before any oil company would be interested? Or are the oil companies rubbing their hands together, just give me a shot at it, come on, really, where are they?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard question to answer. Probably the National Oil Company that's been around since the 1970s, that probably will continue moving forward regardless of what the regime is. And again, there have been a lot of successful examples of national oil companies. It's not, you know, the model we've had in the United States, but there have been. But I think the key to success is for that national oil company to partner with those external firms that have oil and gas operations all over the world. in order to allow for all of that knowledge and all of that information to be able to then be applied to Venezuelan production. So there's that piece of it. And then there's just the capital uncertainty piece. And so, you know, where does that capital come from? Of course, if you're in an economic situation that the government has, you know, really significant reduction in revenues, the people are, you know, obviously having a really hard time economically. It's really hard to say, okay, well, let's go and take all this capital and deploy that whenever people are not having their basic needs met. So then the question comes, okay, well, where's that capital going to come from? And in a place that you have political certainty and companies can come in and do that, that's one way to get what's called foreign direct investment, where capital comes from all over the world and then is deployed. But of course, the companies are going to need to know that they're going to be able to sell that product and earn a profit on it. So that's the balance that that Venezuela will likely be trying to strike over the next few years.
So if I were to have family in Venezuela, how does the oil go from the ground and somehow turn into cash into the pocket of the average Venezuelan so that that per capita GDP goes back up to somewhere where it was or close?
Yeah, so PDVSA, which again is the National Oil Company of Venezuela, they are the largest source of revenue for the Venezuelan government. And so, of course, there's the production of the oil itself, and that oil can be sold onto the global market. And we saw in the last few weeks, of course, there were some crude shipments that were being blocked by the United States. And so that's, you know, one source of revenue. But then they can also take that oil, and there's five refineries, which are also owned by the National Oil Company in Venezuela, that then refine that into products like gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. And then, of course, those products are going to go into the Venezuelan market itself that benefits the consumers there. They have access to energy. But also those products, if they're sold, they can also generate revenue. And so, of course, there's the direct revenue from the activities themselves that go to the government. But then there's the economic impacts of the people within the country that work within that sector and earn earnings and go home and spend that in the economy. And so when you have an economy like Venezuela that is just so concentrated in one commodity, the production of one commodity, what you have is that whenever you have global markets that swing, that can have an outsized impact on the entire country. And so that's really what we're seeing through, again, those direct revenues, as well as through the indirect, the economic activity.
So is the demand there now for what Venezuela has, and it's being mismanaged or the money's being diverted? I'm just wondering.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Ah, DSW, birthplace of the humble brag. Here, the shoes are so good, no one would ever know how little you paid. If you didn't go telling everyone, that is. And with never-ending options for every style, mood, and occasion, all at really great prices, we'll definitely give you something to brag about. So go ahead, stock up on fresh sneakers from your favorite brands. Or try those boots you always secretly knew you could pull off. Find the shoes that get you at prices that get your budget at DSW stores or at DSW.com. Let us surprise you.
Making plans with asthma can be awful. It always goes from, that sounds fun, to, in this weather, what if my asthma acts up? I got tired of saying no, so my doctor suggested Dupixent. I'm Rachel, and I'm sponsored by Regeneron in Santa Fe to share my story with real patients like me.
Dupixent, dupilumab, is an add-on prescription maintenance treatment for adults and children 6 years and up with moderate to severe eosinophilic or oral steroid-dependent asthma that's not controlled with current asthma medicines. Dupixent is not for sudden breathing problems.
Dupixent helps people breathe better in as little as 2 weeks. And now, I don't even think twice about saying yes to plans more, rain or shine.
Severe allergic reactions, including skin reactions, can occur. Get help right away for face, mouth, tongue, or throat swelling, wheezing, or trouble breathing. Tell your doctor right away of signs of inflamed blood vessels like rash, chest pain, worsening shortness of breath, brown or dark colored urine, tingling or numbness in limbs. Tell your doctor of new or worsening skin symptoms, joint aches and pain, or a parasitic infection. Don't change or stop other treatments without talking to your doctor.
Do more with less asthma. Ask your asthma specialist about Dupixent by name. Visit Dupixent.com or call 1-844-DUPIXENT.
Wondering, where's the disconnect here?
Well, I mean, there's the global market. And so, of course, there have been sanctions on Venezuela because of the political instability that you've been talking about with your other guests for the last hour. Mm-hmm. And so countries around the world have said, hey, look, we're not going to do business with Venezuela, and we're going to, you know, block them from doing business with other folks. And that, of course, has that, you know, that negative effect. But if you were to remove that and they were to move forward with a regime that was more accepted by the United States and other countries, then Venezuela could just sell that product onto that global market, and they could see, you know, really, really big benefits from that. And Guyana, by the way, which is right next door, has seen significant production growth over the last 5 or 6 years. And is really economically successful right now selling that product onto the global market. So Venezuela can do it. The fundamentals are there, but they got to get the politics. They got to get the politics figured out.
Appreciate your time. Thank you, Greg.
Anytime.
Have a good day. Greg Upton, Happy New Year to you. Director of LSU Center for Energy Studies, 937, 23 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 9:45, quarter till 10, joined by Ali Cosell, a credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. Happy New Year, Ali. How are you?
Happy New Year to you too, Tommy. Yes, I'm doing well. I'm doing a lot better than, let's say, the Pelicans.
Yeah, boy, they were going well for a while there. Then what happened?
Yeah, so good five-game winning streak. Everybody was getting healthy. You had Herb Jones. That's probably the biggest thing that sticks out to you, simply because the defense has been terrible all season. But when he was playing, when he had returned from an injury, before now leaving with an ankle injury, the team was playing its best defense we had seen all season. And that's why, not coincidentally, they won five games in a row. But since losing Herb, they've lost seven in a row. And in addition, they've also had certain guys out. Sadiq Bey's missed a couple of games. Trey Murphy. Even Derek Queen sat once. So they were continued after that five-game winning streak of playing those competitive basketball games, right? They could have beaten the Knicks. They had two against the Suns. They could have won either one of those. But since that time, they've lost now three in a row by double digits. And when you don't have full strength and you're not a good team and you're terrible defensively, we're kind of seeing it. And that's what we've seen the last three games. They're just not up to par with the rest of the NBA when they're this shorthanded.
How do you go about fixing the defense?
Yeah, that's what James Borrego's pulling his hair out, I think, mm-hmm. every single hour, every waking day. The thing is, I think it's almost impossible, because right now the team, and the numbers clearly show it, they're a much better defensive team when you don't have the rookies out there, right? Teams are picking on Jeremiah Fears and Derek Queen, and the numbers show, the eye test shows it, right? You watch them, they're not able to play and be in spots that they should be on every possession. And so, as long as you're playing them, and you have to, right? You're a bad team. They're clearly the future. You have to develop them. So this is going to be the bumpy part, but this is what you're going to have to endure. Until they figure it out defensively, it's going to be basically one hand tied behind the Pelicans' back.
What about Zion?
Well, Zion's coming off his best stretch. I mean, I know last night he didn't score in the second half against the Miami Heat, but he had been playing really well. He had three straight games of over 30 points. Seems like he had found himself a nice groove. So his offense, it's there. And he's doing several other things, right? He comes up with a defensive play here and there. But this is about the best we've seen him play all season. So from now till the end of the season, what you want to do, Tommy, we've talked about a lot of times, is for him just to stay on the court, be healthy, show that your availability is going to be there for a change.
I was at the game when DeJounte Murray got hurt. It was against the Celtics, was it not?
It was, yeah. Right. It was shortly after that New Year, last New Year.
Right. So tell me about him.
Yeah, so he's nearing a return. Question is, he still hasn't gotten in front of the Pelicans medical staff to where they can do a full evaluation, because he's been working on his rehab away from the team since the season began, which is not unusual. Guys rehabbing Achilles injuries have certain other needs. And they've already developed a pattern with who they're working with to get back to full strength. And it's an injury that usually takes a year plus. But there's a thought, and there was a hope about a month ago, that he would be available at some point this month, like later in towards the month. But now the vibes that I'm getting, it sounds like that we may have to wait at least another month till February. It's not a given, but it sounds like to me that we should see him in uniform at some point.
There's no way the Pelicans would consider trading Zion, is there?
I think they would, honestly. They would? But yeah, Tommy, the thing is the return. You know, for me right now, off limits, without a doubt, the rookies, Queen, Fears. After that, Trey Murphy and Herb Jones, you can clearly see their impact. But after that, it's really a toss-up. So guys like Jordan Poole, even Zion Williamson, and for him, it's largely because of the unavailability. But if you could get three firsts and a good young player in return, I think the Pelicans would jump on it. But those offers haven't been there, nor should they be. I think any team would be afraid to take a chance on him if that's what the asking price is.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Jordan Poole. Talk about him.
Yeah, he's been a huge disappointment, honestly. He's shooting career worst numbers, so much so that it now doesn't make sense for him to be in the starting lineup because he's poor defensively. So when you have that combined with now an offense that's very inefficient, James Borrego, before him Willie Green, had no choice but to move him to the bench. So he was supposed to step in the shoes of C.J. McCollum, right? Be a solid starting shooting guard for this team, one of the younger vets. But because the shot's not falling, he's making a lot of mistakes. And again, he's also been in and out with injury. So we haven't seen probably him at 100% for a stretch of several weeks. But either way, yeah, huge disappointment, Tommy, considering he's making $30 million.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen a noticeable change in the Pelicans, both the way they practice, the way they play, since Willie Green was shown the door?
I do, yeah. Look, I know that I just mentioned that they've had three games in a row of losing by double digits, but that's been honestly out of the norm. Mm-hmm. With James Borrego, they're competing every single night. And that's really, I think, the biggest thing that people should watch for in today's NBA. Teams play hard. They play harder, I feel like, than they ever have in the past. You have to bring it for 48 minutes. And Willie Green's teams, especially this year, certainly wasn't doing it. With Borrego, you've seen the switch. They're running at a much faster pace. Since he's taken over, they've had a top 10 offense. The pace, right, is top three. So they're playing towards an identity. So that means they're listening to him. From what I'm hearing, they're still practicing. They're really trying to take it here in stone. But again, when you got so many young guys and then you're missing like your key defender, you're missing DeJounte Murray, you haven't even seen him, that's why the record is what it is.
Where do you see this going forward?
Well, what you want to see is Borrego finish out the season, which he's going to be given. And I'm going to be very curious with the trade deadline. Would somebody be interested in, say, Zion or Jordan Poole? Because it's clear the makeup of this team is not what you want it to be, right? They're just underperforming, even when they've been close to full strength. So you want to see maybe some moves. But if it doesn't happen, you just want to see the rookies continue to grow, gain some knowledge. And for guys like Trey Murphy, Herb Jones, to figure out some chemistry, because you know they're going to be here with those younger guys.
Is Borrego going to be the guy, or is he the interim guy?
For now, he's still the interim guy. From what I heard, he definitely hasn't locked up, say, a full-time position. But I think, you know, I hope that the Pelicans front office gives him a lot of good, you know, just gives him a really good chance because he has reached this group. I've seen where Alvin Gentry, Stan Van Gundy, how the players have tuned them out. I think with James Borrego, they've tuned him in. The problem is it just hasn't come across in the results. But you can clearly see in their effort levels, the way they communicate with him. I've heard about it behind the scenes in terms of relationships, the way they are with him and back and forth. So I like what I'm hearing. It just, unfortunately, in the W's and L's, hasn't shown up.
Final thoughts, Ollie?
Yeah, we've got, another half a season left. So I want to just see, honestly, Jeremiah Fears, Derek Queen, figure things out more. And because they're going to be easily the fulcrum. And from what we've seen out of Queen, he could be one of the best players in the league, right? There's a chance he could be a top 10 player because he's got that incredible skill set. So you just want to see their growth be uninterrupted. Let them take their bumps. Let them try and figure it out defensively because this team, they'll be better for it next year.
Thank you, Ollie. Appreciate it as always. Have a happy new year.
Yeah, thanks, Tommy. You do the same.
Ollie Kosel, credential NBA writer covering the Pelicans. WWL, of course, your home for the Pelicans tomorrow. Pels take on the Lakers in the Smoothie King Center. Pre-game 6:30, tip-off 7 o'clock on WWL AM 870. We'll take a break, find out what Newell's got coming up today. He's back after the holidays, and we'll find out more when we return on WWL.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Making plans with asthma can be awful. It always goes from, that sounds fun, to, in this weather, what if my asthma acts up? I got tired of saying no. So my doctor suggested Dupixent. I'm Rachel, and I'm sponsored by Regeneron in Santa Fe to share my story with real patients like me.
Dupixent, dupilumab, is an add-on prescription maintenance treatment for adults and children 6 years and up with moderate to severe eosinophilic or oral steroid-dependent asthma that's not controlled with current asthma medicines. Dupixent is not for sudden breathing problems.
Dupixent helps people breathe better in as little as 2 weeks. And now I don't even think twice about saying yes to plans more, rain or shine.
Severe allergic reactions, including skin reactions, can occur. Get help right away for face, mouth, tongue, or throat swelling, wheezing, or trouble breathing. Tell your doctor right away of signs of inflamed blood vessels like rash, chest pain, worsening shortness of breath, brown or dark-colored urine, tingling or numbness in limbs. Tell your doctor of new or worsening skin symptoms, joint aches and pain, or a parasitic infection. Don't change or stop other treatments without talking to your doctor.
Do more with less asthma. Ask your asthma specialist about Dupixent by name. Visit Dupixent.com or call 1-844-DUPIXENT.